Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
Today we're opening up our sources to explore a really pivotal time for northern Syria.
Absolutely. A period that fundamentally reshaped the region with layers that, you know, still resonate today.
Our focus is the area around Afrin, looking at research, historical accounts, some archaeology too. We want to understand the early Muslim conquests starting around 637 AD.
Yeah, what did that transition from Byzantine to early Islamic rule actually look like on the ground? That's the core question.
What do the sources tell us about the changes, the impact on people's lives? It's about uncovering sort of the foundations of a new era.
Exactly.
Okay, let's set the scene first. What was northern Syria, particularly this Afrin area, like just before all this happened, under Byzantine rule?
Well, in the early 7th century, it was definitely Byzantine territory, but it was far from simple or uniform.
Right.
The Afrin Valley itself, sometimes called Oinoparas or Euphrinus in older sources, maybe an echo in the name Afrin, was part of a larger Byzantine region called Syrestica.
Syrestica. And that was important strategically.
Very. Fertile land, east of Antioch and the Amanus Mountains. Controlled key routes.
And its main city was Cyrus, modern Nabi Huri.
That's the one. Khoris or Kurish in Arabic sources. It was a major Byzantine frontier post. Emperor Justinian had actually invested a lot in its defenses back in the 6th century.
So a key administrative hub, too.
Yeah, it was linked with Commagene as the province of Euphratensis. Holding Cyrus meant basically holding Syrestica.
And the people living there. The sources mentioned quite a mix.
Oh, incredibly diverse. You had large Aramaic-speaking communities using Syriac mostly, alongside Greek speakers, especially in administration.
And religiously.
A real mosaic. Different Christian groups, Miaphysites, Chalcedonians who followed Constantinople, Mestorians, plus Jewish communities, Samaritans.
And Arab tribes too.
Yes, absolutely. Various tribes, some Christianized like the Ghassanids and Tunicids, others linked perhaps to the Lachmids, often caught between Byzantium and the Sasanian Persians.
So religious identity was tied up with language, politics, social standing. It wasn't just about faith.
Profoundly so. It shaped everything and really influenced how different groups reacted when the Muslim armies arrived later.
And the economy. Productive.
Very. Grain, silk, but especially olive oil and wine for export. Big money for Byzantium. But it was also a frontier, constantly impacted by the Byzantine-Sasanian wars.
What about those ancient villages or dead cities the sources mention? What did they tell us?
Ah, yes. These sites in the Limestone Massif are amazing. They show incredible prosperity in late antiquity in the countryside.
How so?
Sophisticated farming, huge investment in olive oil and wine production, lots of churches, impressive buildings. It's physical proof of a vibrant rural life and the shift from paganism to Christianity.
Interesting.
But they also hint that Byzantine control wasn't, you know, total, especially in rugged areas like the Amanus Mountains, where groups like the Mardates held out.
Okay, so summarizing the pre-conquest scene. Prosperous, diverse, strategic Byzantine frontier, but complex. Maybe not fully centrally controlled. Lots of different threads.
Exactly. A world about to be, well, dramatically rewoven.
And astonishingly fast, as you said.
Incredibly fast.
Which brings us right to the conquest itself. The 630s, a period of massive, rapid change. The Islamic Caliphate emerges.
Yeah, it was lightning expansion after consolidating power in Arabia, especially under Caliph Umar. The campaigns in the Levant just escalated.
Key Byzantine defeats early on.
In the south, yes. Ajandane fall. Big losses for Byzantium. But the real turning point, the absolute game changer, was the Battle of Yarmouk in 636 AD.
That was the crushing one.
Utterly devastating for the Byzantines. Emperor Heraclius reportedly looked back at Syria and said something like, "Peace be with you, Syria. What a beautiful land you will be for your enemy."
Wow, that really says it all. A sense of abandonment.
It captures it perfectly. He was essentially writing off the province.
So with Byzantium retreating, who were the key Muslim commanders pushing north?
Several important figures. Abu Ubaidah ibn al-Jarrah, he took overall command in the Levant after the initial phase, directing that northern push.
And Khalid ibn al-Walid. He's famous.
Immensely. Known for tactical genius, remember that legendary desert march from Iraq? He was crucial at Yarmouk and in taking Damascus and Aleppo.
Then there's Iyad ibn Ghan. He's linked specifically to Cyrus, right?
Yes, Iyad ibn Ghan. He mainly operated in Upper Mesopotamia, Al Jazeera, but his campaigns definitely pushed into northern Syria, and he's credited with capturing Cyrus.
And his approach was distinctive.
What the sources like al-Balaturi suggest is his pragmatism, especially in this northern region. He combined military force with negotiated surrenders. a lot.
Interesting. Let's track the fall of the big cities up north.
Okay, so after Yarmouk, they moved methodically. Damascus and Homs were early targets. Damascus was finally secured in 636. Homs, taken in 635, became a major Muslim base.
Homs, modern Homs.
Right. And there's a fascinating detail later. Christian Arab allies of Byzantium actually besieged Homs, but Ayyad ibn Gam forced them off by attacking their home territories in Mesopotamia. Shows the complexity.
Always layers. What about Aleppo? Hawab.
Aleppo was a huge prize. Ancient Baroa. Abu Ubaidah and Khalid besieged it. It had strong defenses, especially the citadel, under a commander named Yawuk.
And the sources detail the siege.
Al-Tabari mentions Yukam making sorties fighting back, but eventually, probably around October 637, with no Byzantine relief coming, they surrendered. The garrison was allowed to leave.
And the conversion story.
Al-Tabari does mention Yoakim and maybe 4,000 soldiers converting. But, you know, later historians like Peter Crawford are skeptical, at least about the numbers. It highlights how you have to read these accounts carefully. After Aleppo fell, Azaz, further north, was secured too.
And Antioch, the regional capital.
Antakya, heart of the eastern zone. It fell around the same time, October 637, after a battle nearby at the Iron Bridge. Heraclius had been there but pulled back, choosing to save his forces rather than fight for the city.
Strategic retreat. And Chalcis, Kinasrin.
Very important strategically. Taken maybe 636, 637, it was actually significant enough to become the first capital of the new administrative district, Jen Kinasrin.
And there was an earlier truce there.
Yes, briefly, between Ayyad ibn Gam and a Byzantine governor. Heraclius rejected it, but it shows that negotiation was happening even before the final conquest.
Okay, so where does Cyrus, and by extension the Afrin Valley, fit into this northern sweep?
Cyrus, the main city of Cyrestica, fell to Ayyad ibn Gam during this campaign. Al-Balaturi specifically mentions the people of Cyrus sending a monk to negotiate terms with Ayyad, and later Abu Ubaidah confirmed them.
A monk negotiator. That underlines the negotiation point again.
It really does, and it points to Ayyad's wider strategy in Al-Jazira and northern Syria, often leaving towns intact, people unharmed, in exchange for tribute.
Tribute meaning?
Could be cash, produce, maybe providing guides or labor, practical stuff. It was pragmatic.
Minimize resistance, keep the revenue flowing.
Exactly. The terms for Aleppo safety, property rights, a site for a mosque, probably reflect the kind of principles applied elsewhere, like Cyrus.
And once Cyrus surrendered.
The Afrin Valley, being its rural hinterland within Cyrestica, just naturally came under Muslim control. The fall of the main city implies the submission of the countryside. Control and taxes were the immediate priorities.
It's a striking picture. Conquest achieved as much through deals as through fighting.
It's a crucial insight the sources give us. Makes the speed perhaps more understandable, too.
Okay, that's quite a bit to take in, the speed, the key cities falling, the different strategies at play.
It really was a whirlwind few years. Transformative doesn't quite cover it.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosh Hannah.
Wonderful timing. Always good to see her.
Let's see. Sound of cups. Hope this is a good batch today. Sometimes, you know, they can be a touch bitter. Does it need sugar, do you think?
Pause, sips. No, actually, this one's really nice. Smooth, good warmth, not bitter at all today. Perfect.
Oh, good. Excellent. Okay. Pause. Skin you this for a second. Right then. Refreshed and ready.
Ready when you are.
Okay, so the conquest happens, often involving negotiation. The next massive challenge is actually governing all this newly acquired territory. How did they integrate places like Cyrestica and the Afrin Valley?
They set up a new system pretty quickly, based on military districts, called Ajnad. Plural of Jund.
Ajnad, military districts.
Yeah, it was a practical way to organize things, manage the troops stationed there, collect the taxes, administer the land. For northern Syria, the key district created was Jund Kinasrin.
Named after Kinasrin Chalcis, which we mentioned fell earlier.
Exactly. It was the initial capital, likely because of its strategic location and maybe its existing administrative history.
When was it set up?
Sources like Al-Balaturi mention some debate, maybe under the first Umayyad Caliph Muawiyah, maybe his son Yazid, but fairly soon after the conquests to consolidate control in the north.
But Kinasrin didn't stay the capital.
No, over time it declined. And the administrative center for Jen Kinasrin eventually shifted to Aleppo. Halab just grew much more important commercially. Archaeology at Hadir Canasran is helping us understand that early Canasran phase, though.
So adapting existing structures, but also creating new centers of power.
Right. And the Ajnad system itself often mirrored or adapted the old Byzantine provincial boundaries. It wasn't always a completely clean slate. Pragmatism again.
Makes sense. So Serestica, including Cirrus and the Afan Valley, they fall into Jun Canasran.
Clearly, yes. Serestica became part of Jun Canasran. Now, the Afan Valley itself didn't have a major urban center suitable to be a Jun capital or anything.
So it was administered from elsewhere.
Initially, probably managed via Cirrus, its traditional center. But as Aleppo rose to become the dominant city in the whole Jund, administration for areas like the Afrin Valley would have increasingly centered there. Jun Canasran itself became quite a large area eventually.
Did that structure, Jun Canasran, last?
It evolved. Later on, under the Abbasids, specifically Caliph Harun al-Rashid, around 786 AD, there was a reorganization.
What happened?
The northern, more frontier parts of Jun Canasran were split off to create a new, heavily militarized zone. It was called Jin Alawasim.
Alawasim, meaning?
Something like the strongholds or the defenses. It reflected its role as a buffer zone facing the Byzantine Empire, which was still a major power and threat.
And this is where Cirrus becomes important again.
Exactly. At Nabihuri, Cirrus found itself as a key frontier city within this new Jin Alawasim.
And we have evidence for this.
Yes, archaeological evidence. Finds at Cirrus show minor repairs and renovations to its fortifications dating to the 8th and 9th centuries. It proves it was being actively maintained and used as a strategic military outpost by the caliphate facing Byzantium.
That's a fantastic concrete example of them reusing and adapting the old Byzantine infrastructure for their new reality.
It really is. Shows continuity and change happening at the same time.
Okay, that covers the administrative and military structures. But what about life for the actual people, the diverse communities living there? What were the big socioeconomic changes?
Well, this is where you see perhaps the most profound long-term shifts. The new Islamic administration brought in a new fiscal system almost immediately, and it had huge consequences, mainly because it was tied to religious identity.
You're talking about the jizya and karaj taxes?
Precisely. Non-Muslims, the recognized people of the book, al akitab, so Christians, Jews, Samaritans, they had to pay the jizya. That was a poll tax on adult males.
Okay.
And they also paid the karaj, which was a tax on land, payable in cash or sometimes in kind, like a share of the harvest.
And Muslims.
Muslim landowners, at least initially, paid a different, generally lower tax called usher, or maybe a tenth. Some sources even suggest potentially no land tax at all for Muslims before the mid-8th century, though that's debated.
So a significant difference in the tax burden based purely on religion.
A huge difference. And this is a key point many scholars, like Saleh, for instance, emphasize. This tax disparity created a powerful economic incentive to convert to Islam.
Right. It wasn't just spiritual. Converting meant escaping the jizya and potentially paying less land tax.
Exactly. It becomes a major factor driving what are often termed voluntary conversions. Now, there were tax reforms later, around 750 AD under the Abbasids, that aimed to equalize the land tax, making Muslims also pay the karaj rate. But the jizya remained specifically for non-Muslims.
What about land ownership itself? Did the conquest lead to massive upheaval there?
Not always, or at least not immediately everywhere. The goal was often revenue continuity. Destroying the agricultural base didn't make sense. So in many areas, existing patterns of land tenure, who owned what likely continued just under new rulers and the new tax rules.
And the status of the Christian and Jewish communities under this system.
They were generally classified as Aldima protected people. Meaning, in theory, under the framework often linked to the Pact of Umar, they were allowed to practice their religion, keep their property, run their own community affairs.
In return for
acknowledging Muslim sovereignty and, crucially, paying the jizya tax. Their lives, property, and churches were meant to be protected, though there were often social restrictions, too.
Did all non-Muslim groups experience this the same way?
Probably not. Some sources, like the Syriac chronicler Michael the Syrian, hint that for certain non-Chalcedonian Christian groups, like Miaphysites, who had faced pressure from the official Byzantine church, well, Muslim rule might have initially felt like a relief from that specific kind of coercion. Experiences varied.
And how did people respond overall?
Again, varied responses. We saw some Christian Arab tribes fought alongside Byzantium initially. We saw communities like Cyrus sending monks to negotiate surrender. And then you had groups like the Mardites in the mountains who resisted for a very long time.
So it wasn't a simple acceptance everywhere.
Far from it. And the conditions for these protected communities, the Dhimmi, could also change over time. Sometimes things were relatively tolerant, other times laws might become stricter, increasing pressure, which could also contribute to conversions over the long run.
All these factors together must have led to major demographic shifts over time.
Yes, profound, gradual changes. You had some initial settlement of Arab tribesmen and soldiers, particularly in garrison towns or strategic centers like Canaseran.
But the bigger changes were
Islamization and Arabization, two related but distinct processes.
People converting to Islam and people adopting the Arabic language and culture.
Exactly. Islamization was gradual, driven by those economic factors we discussed, social advantages, intermarriage, and of course, genuine religious conviction for many.
And Arabization.
That was the widespread adoption of Arabic, the language of the new administration, of the Quran, of commerce, culture. Over time, it gradually replaced Greek and, significantly in this region, Aramaic, particularly its Syriac dialect.
Was this mainly due to settlers replacing people?
That's a key point. In many areas like northern Syria, Arabization wasn't primarily about huge waves of Arabian settlers replacing the locals. It was more about the existing indigenous populations, Aramaic speakers, Hellenized groups gradually adopting Arabic language and identifying with Arab culture over generations. Assimilation, really.
Fascinating. This brings us back to those ancient villages, the dead cities. They thrived before the conquest, but were largely abandoned after it, mainly between the 8th and 10th centuries. What does their fate tell us about this whole transformation?
Their abandonment is really intriguing. It strongly suggests the conquest wasn't just political. It fundamentally rewired the region's economy.
How so?
Well, a leading theory is that their whole economy was specialized, heavily focused on producing olive oil and wine for export, primarily to the wider Byzantine world.
Right.
When the region became part of the caliphate, trade routes shifted. Those traditional markets might have dried up, or perhaps access became difficult or less profitable. Their specialized agricultural model might simply have collapsed.
So economic disruption was key.
It seems very likely. Other factors probably played a role, too. Maybe instability during the transition period, changes in land ownership, the burden of the new Kharaj tax making that kind of surplus production less viable. Perhaps people drifted towards the growing cities like Aleppo, which were flourishing under the new system.
Environmental factors. Climate change.
Sometimes mentioned, but the evidence for major environmental shifts causing abandonment in this specific period, 8th, 10th centuries, is generally considered weaker than the socioeconomic explanations.
And ironically, it's because they were abandoned relatively quickly that they're so well preserved today.
Exactly. They weren't continuously rebuilt and lived in for centuries afterwards.
Do we have specific archaeological finds from this period that shed light on what was happening?
Well, as we mentioned, at Cyrus, Nabihuri, the evidence of repairs to fortifications in the 8th, 9th centuries confirms its ongoing role as a frontier post. That's tangible.
Right.
And at Hadir Canaseran, finds like early Islamic pottery confirm its function as an early administrative center for the Jund.
What about in the Afrin Valley itself? Any specific sites from the 7th or 8th century showing the immediate impact there?
That's where the sources we're drawing on are a bit less specific for that immediate post-conquest moment within the valley. Well, we know Afrin was incorporated into Jund Canaseran administratively.
There aren't detailed archaeological reports cited here for that specific time and place.
Exactly. Not for the immediate aftermath illuminating the transition uniquely on the valley floor. Of course, there are older sites like Antdara, but that's much earlier. So the experience of the Afrin Valley as a rural area was almost certainly shaped by the bigger picture, the administration from Cyrus then Aleppo, the new taxes, the economic shifts affecting the whole of northern Syria.
And the gradual processes of Islamization and Arabization would have occurred there, just like elsewhere in the countryside?
Precisely. Influenced by the regional centers.
Okay, so let's try and wrap this up. The story of the Afrin region, and Sarestica more broadly, during the early Islamic conquest starting around 637 AD, is one of incredibly rapid and profound change.
Absolutely. Military conquest, yes. But often, as we saw with commanders like Yad ibn Gum and cities like Cyrus involving pragmatic negotiation, it brought the area swiftly into the orbit of the new Islamic world.
Then came administrative integration into Jund Canaseran, later becoming part of the militarized frontier zone Jon el-Wasim. Places like Cyrus were adapted, reused.
Right, adapting Byzantine structures for new needs. But the really deep, long-term changes were socioeconomic and demographic.
The new tax system, especially the jizya, acting as an incentive for conversion.
Gradual settlement by Arabs, but more significantly, the widespread, slow processes of Islamization and Arabization that reshaped the identity of the majority population over centuries.
And the economic reorientation impacting rural life, possibly contributing to the decline of places like the dead cities.
It marks a fundamental shift. The region goes from being a Byzantine frontier facing east, towards Persia, to being an Islamic frontier facing west, towards Byzantium.
A whole new geopolitical and cultural orientation.
Exactly. By the end of this early Islamic period, northern Syria, including Afrin, is embedded in a new world. But it's a world built on top of and interacting with all those earlier layers, Aramaic, Hellenistic, Roman, Byzantine, creating this incredibly complex cultural tapestry that we still see echoes of.
History as layers, definitely.
Likewise.
So, maybe a final thought for you, the listener, to ponder. How did those specific methods used during the conquest and early rule, the pragmatism, the negotiation, adapting old structures, using taxes as a social lever, how did that particular approach shape the long-term coexistence, the cultural shifts, and ultimately the identity of such a diverse region for centuries afterwards?
And how do these incredibly deep historical roots continue, perhaps in unexpected ways, to influence the region's character and its strategic importance even today?
Something to think about. Thank you for exploring these sources with us today on the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.